Hey everybody, real quick before we start the episode, I'd really like to bring the World SF Tour and the Skiffy Fanny Show to Worldcon this year. Worldcon is in London, if you didn't already know that, which means it's kind of a long way to go, particularly for me as a grad student. So I'm asking folks, if they could, to consider donating to a fundraiser we're running to help with travel expenses. If you go to skiffyfanny.com and you go look in the sidebar on the right there, you'll find a link to the GoFundMe page. Basically, all the details about the thing, what we plan to do at Worldcon, the milestone perks and things like that, all that's listed there, so I don't want to go into too much detail here. But if you support our efforts to explore World SF, and if you enjoyed our episode so far this year, please do consider donating. Every little bit does help, and we really can't do it without the support of listeners like you guys. So the other thing I'll just say is occasionally I will put updates about the fundraiser at the front of the episodes, sort of like what I'm doing now. Right now, we're about $5 from the first milestone perk, which is pretty cool, because I didn't expect we would be that close, considering it just opened. So, other than that, my cat just decided to go crazy. That's fun. Other than that, I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let you guys get to the episode, and enjoy.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But to Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters talk. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 192.
Talking Australian speculative fiction with Tansy Rayner Roberts and Marianne DePiers.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And obviously our special guests are Tansy Rayner Roberts and Marianne DePiers. We'll start with you, Tansy. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everyone. I am a science fiction fantasy writer based in Tasmania, which is the little island right at the bottom of Australia. And I'm also a podcaster with Galactic Suburbia and more recently with Verity, which is an all-female Doctor Who podcast. Yeah, I'm not sure what else to say.
You could mention you got some sort of award thing.
Yeah, it's quite shiny. I won a Hugo last year for best fan writer. For my blog, mostly, or my critical writings, generally. It's very shiny. They're nice. I recommend them.
Fair enough. Awesome. And what about you, Marianne? Tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Hi. Hi, everyone. Well, other than the fact that Tansy and I are very good friends, we don't live in quite very near each other, but I'm also a science fiction and fantasy writer. Primarily started out, I suppose, in science fiction, but been writing a lot of genre blend fiction lately. I've been around on the Australian scene for quite a long time, I guess, and I have three sons, and they've all just left home, so I'm able to write now. It's wonderful.
Excellent. And if I recall correctly, don't you have work coming out with Angry Robot?
I do. I have a science fiction western / occult Australiana something or other. Yeah, very very kind of eclectic blend of genres and really looking forward to it. So that's the first adult science fiction novel I've done in a little while. I've been writing YA for the last couple of years, so I'm really excited about it.
Excellent. We'll probably talk a little bit about that towards the very end, have you maybe talk a little bit of the kind of details of that. But so in any case, the sort of topic for today was discussing very broadly Australian speculative fiction. And I really kind of wanted to start because I don't know how much people on our side of the world, Julia and I's side of the world, are actually familiar with the sort of development of genre fiction in Australia. But I did find a really amusing fact while I was looking, because I'm not terribly familiar, and found out that American pulps during World War II were banned in Australia.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
Like this weird fact, like, yeah, they just gone banned. So it was it was really difficult during that period, apparently, for people to get a lot of science fiction. And so people just wrote their own. Yeah, there's apparently there's a book. Oh gosh, what's the name of the author now? Where did his name go? By Russell Blackford, called Strange Constellations: History of Australian Science Fiction. I think it's in there from Greenwood. Yeah, and it just talks. I just thought that was so fascinating that this is in part where genre fiction kind of really gets its initial burst in Australia, from this moment when there's an embargo. Excuse me, it was in 1929, leading into World War II. So, but yeah, so anyway, I don't know where I was going with that.
Well, that's actually really interesting, Tansy. That would make a great blog or topic for Galactic Suburbia. Russell's been an academic and a critic on the Australian scene for a long time, and I don't think many people realise that, of our generation anyway. What do you think, Tansy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've been spending a lot of time recently with another of our science fiction academics, Helen Merrick, because she recently moved down to Tasmania. It's rather nice living somewhere really nice. People want to move there. And yeah, she's done a lot of work on the history of the field and stuff. But I mean, yeah, and I think there's a lot of hidden history that we don't really hear much about the really early days. And yeah, absolutely. It'd be nice to dig out a few more of those little nuggets of information and the lost classics, because I suppose that's a big business at the moment in science fiction and fantasy, isn't it? Is finding all the lost out of print classics and bringing them back.
Well, and particularly in the case of Australia, I mean, there were a lot of authors that I was kind of noticing when I was poking around, of people I'd never even heard of, but they're mentioned as significant people in the development of your particular genre scene. And I'm like, well, why are we not heard about these people? They seem very important. But, you know, it is kind of one of those things where, you know, that the history just needs to be told perhaps in more depth. But I see Julia had a hand. So why don't you jump in, Julia?
So, well, I was wondering, instead of just speculating about what we might know, wondering, since Marianne and Tansy are both actually from Australia, what was your experience growing up with science fiction and fantasy? How did you get interested in the genre and decide to become writers? And I guess I'll start with you, Tansy, and then give it to Marianne after that.
Okay, well, I got into fantasy and science fiction as a genre in my early teens, mostly out of peer pressure. I went to a girls' school, and there was a very small group of my friends who were totally into science fiction and fantasy, and so I read it socially and got hooked. But it never occurred to me that it was something that was published in Australia, and I actually, because it wasn't, this was in the early 90s, and there wasn't a lot, as far as mainstream publishers, it just didn't seem to be happening. All the big fantasy series that I read came out of America or the UK. And then I remember the first time I found a fantasy book on the shelf, which not only had an Australian author, but had been published in Australia. And it was a book called The Madrigal by Beverly McDonald. And I think I found some of Tony Shillitoe's books in a secondhand bookshop. And that was just, it was just mind-blowing for me, because up till that point, I did want to write. And I was very interested in writing from about the age of, I think 13 was when I started writing my first fantasy series. It had proposed 8 to 10 books in it. It was very ambitious. But no, just the idea that you could actually get published in Australia in science fiction and fantasy had seemed quite impossible. And then suddenly I started finding a couple of books here and there. And of course, in the mid-90s, in I think 95, was when HarperCollins set up their Voyager imprint in Australia. And suddenly there was a lot more mainstream science fiction and fantasy in particular on the shelves, published in Australia, not just imported. And that was when Sarah Douglas started out, who was one of our big names. And yeah, so that to me, that was a really kind of critical, that was just before I started university. So it was a very exciting, inspiring time. And round about the same time was when I started also occasionally finding science fiction small press magazines in a real newsagent, and discovered that there was actually this small press short story industry ticking along beneath the surface that I'd never had any idea of. So that was quite critical for me. Marianne, what about you?
Actually, I guess it was quite a similar experience for me. Although I probably read my first science fiction novel in my 20s, so I was a little bit later than you. which was Arthur C. Clarke, and I kind of that switched me on initially to science fiction, and then I discovered all the David Eddings, all the fantasy sagas. But it wasn't until I saw a Sarah Douglas fantasy novel in the bookshops, bought it, and realised she was Australian, that I had that exact same revelation that this was possible for me, that I could do this if Sarah could do this. So she was quite, even though she certainly wasn't the first science fiction or fantasy writer in Australia, she was the first one to gain the kind of international recognition that, you know, made her a bit of a household name. And I think that she was the beginning of the new revolution for us out here. And then, as Tansy said, we've developed this incredibly healthy industry of small press that are blooding new authors and giving them the opportunity to have their voice heard and being seen internationally, and many of them going on to having successful careers.
This actually makes me wonder a question, since it seems that some of these the earlier works, I mean, Tansy, you're talking about in the kind of the 90s and your early college years, kind of discovering all of this work. And I'm curious if there are, in your opinions, certain themes or issues that seem to appear quite frequently in fiction written by Australians, or perhaps even by people who move to Australia and then write. I imagine there must be some, but I'm kind of curious what you kind of think on that, and maybe just start with you, Tansy, just kind of go that direction.
Yeah, well, I think there's an ongoing awkward relationship, I guess, or not necessarily awkward, sometimes quite a thoughtful, interesting relationship that Australian science fiction and fantasy writers have with the landscape and with Australianness, because so many of the most iconic works in the genre are, whether they come out of the UK or the US, they have a kind of default Northern Hemisphere-ness about them. There's a certain thing where if you put in certain trees and certain plants and certain animals, nobody's going to blink an eyelid, because that's quite normal. And it doesn't matter that the hobbits have umbrellas. Nobody really worries about that sort of thing. But try and put a wombat or a kangaroo in there and eyebrows are going to hit the ceiling. And added to that, a level of cultural cringe. So there's that thing of Australian writers either ignoring their own landscape in favour of the more English or the more European landscapes, but also just trying subtly to bring it in and make it be something that is accessible to international readers. I mean, how do you write fantasy? I think Sean Williams is one of our big writers who's worked very hard in trying to write fantasy that appeals to, I guess, conventional fantasy audiences, but is very influenced by the South Australian landscape, which is not like anything else, really. In fact, they had a 50 degrees Celsius day yesterday, apparently. So that's alarming. So we have our deserts and our beaches and our gum trees, and trying to factor that in some way to not just fantasy, because science fiction as well. In some ways, I think it's been more successful in science fiction because we have this lovely long tradition of dystopia and futuristic Australianness, whereas in fantasy, it's a bit harder, but it's just one of the things that I think Australian fantasy writers always have to think about, even if they end up not factoring it in at all. It's quite hard to live in a landscape which is not the tradition. It doesn't really connect to any kind of fantasy default. And I suppose there must be a lot of American authors in various locations that aren't particularly green and verdant and full of, sheep, who also have to deal with this sort of thing. But I think the Australian landscape, especially because an awful lot of it is trying to kill us on a regular basis, does mean it is something that factors into a lot of the work, both the very mainstream, well, the bestseller types, but also very, very much in the small presses. So even when you weren't seeing it in the big the big trilogies and the big fantasy work, you were definitely seeing it in the small press. And the same with the fantasy art. I mean, Sean Tan, who's probably one of our biggest exports, I guess, as far as somebody who started in the small presses and built up to the point of, that Oscar thing that he won for his art, he's done a fascinating job of factoring in the Australian landscape and Australiana with his work, and a lot of his early work was basically, let's do a spaceship cover that evokes a boomerang or a kangaroo and things like that. and then it got subtler later.
I really like, hopefully I can just jump in really quick and then have you speak for just in a moment, Marianne. I'm really curious about this idea that you brought up, Tansy, that some of the genre fiction has sort of pushed for the kind of European setting, because it's something that I think we've had discussions about it in the past in fantasy in general, this idea that Europe is the default. And it just seems so odd that Australia would be a place where that is also a common feature, considering how unique Australia is, and also it's not exactly like an obscure place.
Well, you'd think not, but you know, you were talking about a lot of authors that we have that are hugely significant to us that you might not have heard of. That's because their work isn't published outside Australia. Sometimes there is that question of, is your work going to be sold outside the country? And there is a concern. Some people have managed it and some haven't, and there is always that concern that the more parochial it is or the more Australian relevant it is, maybe the less likely it is to travel, which is very sad. But also that odd thing about feeling inferior to Europeans, it's been going on in Australian literature and art generally for a long time. Like, you know, 200 years ago they had issues with artists coming out to Australia from England and painting English trees because that was what they were used to seeing, even though the very different trees were in front of them. There is always this sense of, I guess, the big literature or the important books come from another place, and maybe if we just write about our own stuff it seems smaller or less significant. And there's been a lot of trying to overcome that. And, of course, when you try and overcome that and it just becomes rah, rah, rah Australia, then that becomes embarrassing in whole different ways. So, yeah, there's still a lot to unpack there.
Fair enough. Well, what about you, Marianne?
Well, Tansy covered a fair bit of kind of the stuff that I would say as well. I would guess I would add to it that certainly there's been a good tradition of post-apocalyptic literature in small press here, and very much tapped into the landscape, as Tansy said. I think that it goes even past the cultural cringe and the fact that we've seen ourselves as lesser, and that we must write fiction that is easily digestible by the rest of the world. I actually believe that's largely driven by a lot of the publishers in terms of, stuff that's been sold internationally. I think that even if you want to write, and I mean, I'm speaking from experience here because my first series was post-apocalyptic Australia science fiction. I've written a crime that is extremely Australian-centric, and there is a very tangible obstruction to being able to sell that to publishers because they don't see that it's going to be marketable overseas. So we're not just facing the history, we're facing the actual reality of perceptions within the publishing industry, and that's where small press is so incredibly important. You know, 12 Planet Press, as you all know, Alyssa Krasnostein and Tansy's connected with Collective Suburbia, ran a fantastic 12 Planets, I think it's called, Tansy, isn't it?
Yes.
12 Planets series of novellas. It was all science fiction written by Australian women, where the connection with the landscape with some of them was just absolutely fantastic and unashamedly Australian. And there wasn't that sense of, as Tansy mentioned at the end, that we must talk about our country. It was just a very natural kind of extension of their writing. So we are caught in this strange sort of ravine where we're scrabbling to get out, but the gravel keeps falling in on top of us kind of thing. So, but yeah, definitely there is no doubt the landscape is the landscape and the flora and the fauna of Australia are areas that a lot of speculative fiction writers are very drawn to exploring.
Julia, you want to jump in?
Yeah, so you guys have been mentioning some Australian authors that are big in Australia but not around the rest of the world, and also the struggle of people getting published outside of Australia and who makes it and what significant factors there are to what they write and what the publishers will pick up and market worldwide. The names that leap to my mind when I think of Australian writers that I've seen in my local bookstores and libraries are Margot Lanigan, Garth Nix, Trudy Canavan, and I'm not even sure I'm coming up with more names than that I would expect to see on a bookshelf in a random bookstore that I would walk into here. What are some of the names of people that you think are either bigger in Australia or should be big elsewhere? Oh, I guess Justine Larbalestier, but she kind of married an American, so that she lives here half the time.
That disqualifies her.
It doesn't disqualify her. She's still very Australian, and a lot of her work actually reflects that. But I think it does change the way that she can deal with publishers, because when you're coming from inside the U.S., speaking to a U.S. publisher is a little different than when you're coming from outside the U.S. So I guess I'll throw it to you, Marianne, first, and then we'll go back to Tansy.
Wow, where do I start? Honestly, there are so many, and I'm going to miss a whole bunch of people. I think of people recently. Well, Tansy is one, absolutely and without a doubt. And she's been publishing not only her fantasy with HarperCollins, but also crime with 12th Planet Press. There's people like Jo Anderton, who published with Angry Robot her first series. Trent Jamison, Richard Harland, Maxine MacArthur. I could just go on and on. It's just that a lot of these writers will either only have been published in Australia or in the Commonwealth, or they may have had one series out in the shelves in the American market, and not enough to make an impact to have their name mentioned. Tansy, who have I forgotten? Please help me here.
Let me think. Well, see, I want to talk about Glenda Luck, but I think she's in the opposite situation where she still seems to be selling better overseas than locally. But I think she's a name we should be hearing more of internationally because of her work. Kate Forsyth is one that comes to mind. I don't know if her first series, like, she's starting to be known now because she internationally, because her fairy tale novels have really taken off the last couple of books, especially but Bitter Greens, which she wrote a couple of years ago. It was a magnificent historical Rapunzel novel, which I was just amazed that it didn't get as much international recognition as it should have done. But she had like a 7-book fantasy series that was one of our really big sellers in Australia, and I don't think it ever has. Jennifer Fallon is one of our big bestseller epic fantasy writers, who's, I'm pretty sure her books have never been distributed outside Australia.
They have.
Okay.
I have some of her books.
Okay, yeah. Well, there you go. That's the other thing, we're not always that sure which ones are and which ones aren't.
Her first fantasy series, the large one, actually did sell it in the US. So we have Karen Miller. We have a lot of fantasy writers that are quite successful now, like Glenda and Karen Miller. Who else, Tansy? Should have written myself a list.
See, I did write a list, but I think I missed a lot off.
Sean Williams is the obvious one, of course. But, Sean's huge in Australia. And of course, now he partners with Garth Nix in a series too.
Yeah. Now, there are quite a few who they either break out overseas at a different time as in Australia, or their works kind of sometimes sell better. Because we also have a lot of things where Australian books might sell into the UK, but not necessarily into the US. Yeah. And of course, the UK, while being quite significant in our eyes, is also a much smaller market. Actually, getting Australian books to the US becomes a bit of a hurdle. Yeah, absolutely.
Tans, I was just going to say, maybe actually what we could do is, can you guys publish a list of names we could put together for you post this podcast?
I could put it in the show notes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So anyway,
and I should say that
podcast,
I've been typing up any names that you say as you say them. So anything that you've mentioned, I've been writing down as you go. And then if you can give us a list afterwards, I can send you what I have and you can supplement it and we can put that in the show notes.
Fantastic, Julia. That would be perfect. And then I will have a moment to collect my brain.
Well, okay, that would be great. And that'll give folks who are interested a really big reading list, which they will promptly start.
Well, I actually have another question related to this. So before we stray away from this topic, so the second part of this question is, you both mentioned small presses and you both mentioned how much wonderful work they're doing. Now, of course, you mentioned 12th Planet Press, Marianne, and I'm obviously very well acquainted with them since I am co-editing an anthology with Elisa for 12th Planet Press myself. But what other presses should people be checking out? Where are places that people outside of Australia might look where they can find good Australian speculative fiction that isn't in the major publisher?
Well, pick me. Can I say this first? Tansy.
Definitely. Go for it.
Tansy can fill in my gaps. Fablecroft, who are closely associated with 12th Planet Press, they're fantastic. They're doing Tahani Wesley. They're doing publishing some great stuff. Cœur de Lion, which is Keith Stevenson, who is also just started an online magazine called X6 or Dimension 6, I think.
Yes.
We can certainly add this to the show notes too. Satellite Publishing by Stephen Ormsby is very new, working hard to build their profile. And also Ticonderoga, who have been going for probably longer than 12th Planet Press, Russell B. Farr. Tansy, anyone else there?
Clandestine out of Melbourne. Now, they do different genre stuff, but they, like Fablecroft, have done a bit of bringing old works back into print. And I particularly, Clandestine, have been publishing the earlier fantasy works of Kerry Greenwood, who's... She's quite famous in Australia for her crime writing, particularly the Phryne Fisher 1920s crime series that's just become a massive TV success story after 20 years of publishing the novels. But her Greek myth heroine novels, which I loved in my teens, have just been reprinted by Clandestine, who also do that sort of thing. You mentioned Fablecroft, and yeah, Tahani from Fablecroft is doing very similar things. So I mentioned Glenda Lark, who's one of our big epic fantasy writers. Fablecroft have brought out her backlist, basically. They're bringing out her early works in ebook form to make them more accessible, because there are a lot of books that weren't, even if they were sold overseas, they're not able to be found necessarily now. And it's only because Australian publishing have been quite slow to really make the most of e-publishing. And so there's a lot of books that haven't been accessible until now. So that sort of thing is starting to happen. The small presses are often picking up projects which have fallen through the cracks or bringing back the early work. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any more off the top of my head. I'm sure there are some.
That would be the core five or six. And I think Fablecroft is bringing out Mokhlok, they bring out the entire Mokhlok Chronicles, Tansy, of your book?
Yes. Yeah, they have. My first two novels were part of a comic fantasy series, and the third one was never published. And they're now all available, thanks to Fablecroft, by ebook. And she's actually put out a print edition of Ink Black Magic, which is the one that was never quite published. So little projects like that. She's also picked up the third Jo Anderton novel. I think she had two out with Angry Robot and intended there to be a third in the series, and they didn't continue with the series. And so Fablecroft are making it available. So, yeah, it's nice to have options other than self-publishing yourself, which is what a lot of authors are going to, and that works for them, but it's quite nice to have small press partnerships coming in and picking up these projects that maybe wouldn't, they're not necessarily going to work on a commercial level with mainstream publishing, because you have to sell so many more copies to make it viable, whereas the small presses can be more experimental and take more risks. and go for stuff that has more, perhaps a small core fan audience who are interested, the niche audience stuff. And it's where you get all the diversity. So, yeah.
That, I absolutely love what Australian Small Press is doing, because each of these individual publishers is creating their own niches. Tansy said, they have quite clear ideas about the sorts of things that they're prepared to publish, and it's just that freedom to really celebrate the genre and the stuff that they love, which is a bit along the lines of what Angry Robot has been successful with, I think, by not being restricted by what they think is going to sell, 40,000 copies plus, it's just that wonderful freedom to actually take the genre forward, which I think commercial publishers really struggle to do that, because they're trying to constantly produce work that's going to appeal to so many people that they won't take any risks. So yeah. I find it very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we had about 10 years in which almost no science fiction was being published out of Australia. I think pretty much, Marianne, for a while there, you were the only science fiction writer. Yeah. And even then, you were struggling to find publishers that were interested, because they just dropped science fiction across the board. It was the small presses that picked it up. Urban fantasy, there have been very few urban fantasy success stories in Australia. For some reason, it hasn't taken off at that larger commercial level with more than a couple of authors. So the small presses are kind of have kept that stuff going. So a lot of the time it's filling in the gaps to find the stuff that people want to read, but maybe just not quite as many people as want to read the latest George R. R. Martin. So, yeah, it's been quite inspiring to be part of that and to see how much the community, it's really the small press community that fuels a lot of the conventions and the community of the conventions. There's just always been a lot of people who, they'll go along to the science fiction convention, the national convention, whatever, and they will pick up that year's worth of small press books, because there are very few bookshops that stock them. A lot of it is done through mail order and just through convention stall selling.
Yeah. Another name that springs to mind is Rowena Corey-Daniels, who's been very successful in the last few years publishing fantasy with Solaris.
Oh, okay.
But she's also had small, novels published with Clandestine in small press. So find a lot of our authors are, have multiple projects going, internationally but locally as well. And, which is allowing them to write not only genre blend novels but also across genres. So I think the whole electronic publishing revolution has given us greater flexibility as writers. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Tansy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you're right. We're seeing a lot of authors taking the projects that they think will be, looking at projects and saying, well, this one is a mainstream press one and this one is not, and going to the indie presses for that, because you get more support than doing it on your own. You still get great editorial, you can get the good graphic support and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And as I said, get the community aspect to it. And so I'm seeing a lot of very well-known writers preferring to team up with one of the smaller publishers. And when we say small press in Australia is a lot smaller than small press in the US or the UK. You might be talking about, little boutique press stuff. You might never have more than 500 copies, if that. But you're getting that support, and you're getting, it's much more of a team process.
I had
to do more experimental stuff. And Margot is a really good example. She's one of our biggest names now, as far as awards and critical acclaim for her speculative fiction, especially when she started bringing out the novels. But she did one of the 12th Planet collections, 4 short stories, which are actually with Cracklescape, was her 12th Planet book. And in that, she really kind of pushed out all the stops. She wrote stuff she hadn't really written before. She wrote very Australian short stories, which is not something she's really done explicitly before. The wonderful feminist stories. And it was a great little book. And it came out within a month or so of Sea Hearts, which has been her biggest novel release to date. And it's really nice to see the very successful writers also supporting the small presses, because it kind of goes both ways. Giving a project like that to a small publisher, it supports them as well as giving you support, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I had an amazing experience. I published a collection of short stories with 12th Planet Press, and I don't think you can replicate the experience of a good relationship with an indie publisher, with a major publisher, because of the level of involvement. I mean, Alyssa and I discussed, it was illustrated. We had a lot of discussion about the illustration. It was so collaborative, and I think Alyssa will agree that it was just a wonderful experience. And that's why, I think that's why, people want that experience, as well as becoming kind of, you know, it kind of makes up for sometimes that sense that you might be just a number or another title on a book cover that you can experience with the major publishers. So I love indie press. I think it is absolutely, it is the power, not the powerhouse of the industry, but it's definitely the future of the industry. I think without them, we fold. That's where we get all our new ideas. And as I said, that's where we push the boundaries. But that's also where we build the relationships, you know, the relationships that are so important to us in our community.
I wanted to jump in. I mean, this is all really, really interesting, that this how important small presses are in the field currently. I mean, it's a conversation that sometimes is had in the U.S. about small presses, because small presses, I think, sometimes are very much like that in the U.S. But it's really interesting to hear how you feel that it is rooted in the field in Australia. And one of the things that I think it was Tansy that may have sort of passingly suggested a question of diversity in terms of the presses, and it made me wonder, in part because of Tansy, you're part of Galactic Suburbia, so gender issues are obviously important, but even more broadly, do the small presses, or just in general, is genre fiction publishing in Australia, is it representing a wide range of diversity, not just in terms of maybe thematic concerns, but in terms of the authors or the kinds of characters being represented? And I mean, it's not just in terms of gender. I was actually really curious too about local populations such as Aboriginal groups, which I must confess I know very little about in terms of any published work from that particular group of individuals. But maybe you guys have some insight there. I'm not sure. I just kind of threw that out, like, you guys, like, yeah, you'll both just talk at the same time. maybe I just start with you, Tansy, and we'll just go to Marianne, and she can jump in after that.
I think, you know, we talked about Sarah Douglas before, and as far as gender stuff goes, I don't think we can in any way doubt the fact that it was significant that the first really prominent, best-selling, set the world on fire fantasy author in Australia, published in Australia, was a woman. Because that definitely is something that has characterized certainly the HarperCollins Voyager list, which was our biggest mainstream fantasy publisher for a really long time. Like, for about a decade, they didn't really have a lot of competition as far as the amount of work that they put out and the support they gave that work. So after Sarah Douglas, there came many other very successful best-selling fantasy authors who were women, to the point where some of the conversations about, for instance, women in epic fantasy or female authors in epic fantasy often comes as a bit of a shock to Australians, because we're so used to seeing the conversation feature people like Sarah and Jennifer Fallon and Trudy Canavan and Glenda Lark and the Karen Miller. We're used to those names being... you know, there are a few men as well. There's Sean Williams and Garth Nix, but we're just so used to seeing so many big female names in our conversations about, well, epic fantasy, which has been the biggest subset, really, of science fiction and fantasy in Australian publishing since the mid-90s. But yeah, it always comes as a bit of a shock when you hear the conversations overseas. It's got, oh, hang on, has anybody mentioned any women yet? So that's already there in some ways in some of the mainstream stuff. And again, authors like Glenda Lark, you're finding characters with racial diversity and stuff like that. That's coming from mainstream publishers as well. But I do think that the indie presses have a lot. They have a lot to offer. As far as there are very few authors that I can think of. And the Aboriginal issue is, I mean, there are very, very few fantasy or science fiction writers. We have Amberlynn Quaymolina, who is a YA author who started getting attention just the last couple of years. I think she has been nominated for, I think, possibly won an Aurealis Award over the last 2 years. And she has a couple of books out. But there's a lot of issues that come in with Aboriginal authors, particularly using Aboriginal stories and themes in fiction, which is problematic because in the one hand you want visibility and you want to kind of incorporate that sort of stuff into what you see in published work, but there are also very deep cultural factors to take into account, in particular the fact that even repeating stories from a particular group or tribe can be seen as offensive. Even if you're a member of that community, if you're not, then it's just, you know, it's just completely not the done thing at all. But when you even have Aboriginal writers where there's a lot of stuff that they won't or can't write about, it does become very difficult because then it just becomes invisible. So this is something that's ongoing and it's something that we kind of, I think, want to see a lot more of in science fiction fantasy. Certainly incorporation of multiculturalism and the themes that come out of that. And I am seeing a lot more of that in the small presses, I guess. One author I wanted to mention was Ben Peak, who has up till now been a very indie writer, writing very experimental, interesting work. His novel Black Sheep was a small press novel which dealt very heavily with racial themes. A science fiction novel came out a few years ago. And that was really, really interesting. But it is, I don't know, it's something that we still see people shying away from a lot because we have so many ongoing cultural and racial issues in Australia. And I think a lot of people just don't want to write about them. So, yeah, it's awkward. But I see a great improvement and things starting to happen. So I see more acknowledgement of diversity, more diverse casts. There's a lot of and seeing that in fantasy and science fiction in particular. Karen Healy is a New Zealand writer who I always want to talk about in conjunction with Australian writing because it's not like very many people are going to do a New Zealand special episode. Because there aren't
we
as many writers.
We actually are going to do it.
Oh, are you?
Yes,
that's
we
awesome.
Are.
I'm still going to talk about Karen because she wrote her first two novels when she was still living in Australia, and her latest one, which she wrote in New Zealand, is set in Australia. But she's a great YA author, and she writes amazingly about diversity. You know, she always has really her work always has really complex and interesting ensemble casts which represent different shades of different kinds of sexual identity and different racial mixes and actually acknowledges it instead of the quiet just putting them there and hoping people give you a quiet thumbs up. You know, she actually does write stuff which engages with racial issues. And her last book in particular, When We Wake, which is a story of a girl who is cryogenically frozen after being shot, after being killed. She's cryogenically frozen and then reawoken in a future Australia. And it's quite like she interacts so strongly with so many of the current political issues in Australia, with migration and immigration issues, with racism, with what things might have improved in 100 years and what things really might not have improved. And I found it fascinating. It's a really, really good, slightly scary political YA dystopia thriller. And yeah, she engaged with issues to do with race and racism so in such interesting ways for something which was billed as being a, hey, it's Sleeping Beauty done as science fiction. It's so much more than that.
That
so I
awesome.
Thoroughly recommend that one. Yeah. Marianne, what did you have to add to this one?
Well, I guess there was kind of two parts to the question. One was, do we have many Indigenous writers, and is there much Indigenous and gender content to the fiction itself? So in terms of the speculative fiction community, unfortunately, we don't have an awful lot of Indigenous writers that I am aware of, other than Amberlynn. I mean, there probably are, but nobody springs to mind. I don't know if I'm right off the mark here, but I sense that a lot of the great Indigenous fiction in Australia is very much in the literary fiction arena. And that's where their voices are starting to be heard in contemporary and literary fiction, not so much speculative fiction. And I hope that changes. In terms of the actual content of our fiction and whether, you know, there's we address gender topics and racial topics, I think Tansy covered that pretty succinctly. I think that we certainly... our speculative fiction writers cover gender issues as much or as less as any other speculative fiction writers around the world. But the whole incorporation of our Indigenous mythology is very, very, very problematic. And I've touched on it a little myself, in a sense that my science fiction, and I felt that in some ways it was easier to do it with science fiction because I was writing about, you know, a far future situation where I was actually never really identifying it as you know, wasn't deeply connected with current Indigenous mythology. I was able to, you know, subvert that. And, you know, I had to think long and hard before I touched on those subjects because of, you know, out of respect for the community and how I handled that. And in the end, I decided that if I could live with what I had written in terms of content, you know, in the fiction about Indigenous mythology, and that I had done my due diligence and talked to people I needed to, that I could proceed. So, but it is a very, very difficult area. And as Tansy said, when even the Indigenous writers are very careful about how they handle it, then that leaves the rest of us kind of in a bit of no man's land. So it would be nice to see more. You know, there's a lot of Indigenous literature, short fiction and literally just books of mythology and that, which are fantastic. And to see more of that actually in our speculative fiction would be so exciting. So I guess, and I hope, that is something we have to look forward to. So that's about what all I had to add to that.
Awesome. It's just an interesting topic for me because I'm a post-colonial scholar, so I'm always really interested in Indigenous groups. So I'm going to definitely look up, I believe
Amberlynn.
It's Amberlynn. Yeah, I'm going to look up her work and check that out. That'll be something that I mean, it's not my field, but it is, like, in terms of, like, I'm not an Australian expert, but it is something I'm very interested in. So, but I don't want to talk about it too much. I want to go to Julia, who had a hand. So go, Julia.
Well, the first thing I wanted to say is that, yes, what Marianne was saying about people being very careful with co-opting that, I know that here we have this similar problem with Native Americans. And I think if you're not a Native American, you should think very hard before you try to tell something from that culture, just because... that culture has been so stomped on, and those people have the right to tell their story. But if you tell their story, that's not letting them do that. So I can see why people would be very careful with putting Indigenous characters in when even the Indigenous people themselves are being very careful with it. So that's a very good point. And I would love to see more groups like the Carl Brandon Society kind of worldwide actually helping the different groups who aren't very well represented to come together and get some more representation.
Yeah.
But that aside, what I actually put my hand up for that I had a question about was that you guys have both mentioned awards and conventions. You mentioned the Aurealis Award and the NatCon. I know you've both won Australian awards, and I wanted to know if you would tell us, assuming that the average listener to this podcast is not from Australia and doesn't know anything about the Australian fandom and awards scene, what is it like in fandom and what is it like with awards? So I guess I'll start with you, Marianne, and I'll ask you to tell me about awards. And then, since Tansy is our best fan writer winner, if Tansy wants to tell us a little bit about fandom. But, like, basically, you can, of course, supplement each other as well. So, Marianne?
Well, I'll start by saying I don't think Tansy has a shelf big enough for her awards. Is that correct?
They might not all be on one shelf.
Mine, on the other hand, are very comfortably on one shelf. Look, the Aurealis Awards are our premier speculative fiction awards. They grew out of a back room in Victoria, and you know, the back of a bookshop or something along those lines. And then gradually over the years, grew into something quite special. They had spent a few years in Queensland, where the profile increased even more, and so now we have, you know, really very, very big support for that award. So that's been fantastic. We also have all the awards that are associated with the National Convention every year, which are not connected to the Aurealis Awards. And Tansy's probably more qualified to talk about the Ditmars having won a few. But, you know, there's a number of awards that go with the National Convention, so just like the World Science Fiction Convention. So there are two main areas, the Aurealis Awards and then the NatCon Awards, including the Ditmars. So the Ditmars, it's a very much a community voted for awards. Whereas the Aurealis are peer judged, or at least industry judged. So you have a judging panel for them. So you're getting a slightly different skew, on the selection. And which I think is a healthy thing. I think you need to have a combination of both of those. And I think they're highly regarded, both of them. And the community works very hard every year to put on a good show. So Tans, over to you.
Another of the differences between, well, the Aurealis ones, there's a judging panel for each category. It becomes this massive, and our friend Tahani actually is one who organises the judges. It's one of the most complicated things now is the actual organising is, because they have a different 3 to 4 person jury for every category, including things like horror novel, short story, science fiction novel, science fiction short story, fantasy for both, and the collected works, the graphics. So it's a very wide and diverse sort of thing, and yeah. So there's that, and then the Ditmars is a little bit more all in together. Like, for instance, the Ditmars has the best novel, and that's it. It could be science fiction, it could be fantasy, and that's kind of it for the year. And it's always voted on by the much as Marianne said, like the Hugos with the World Science Fiction Convention, the Ditmars are voted on by the membership of the National Convention that year, and that moves around from state to state. They're hosted by different conventions. At the moment, the most common ones are in Melbourne, Perth, or Canberra, with occasional ventures to Sydney or Brisbane, or indeed Hobart, which hasn't done it for a while. I ran the last one that was in Hobart, but that was back in 2005, just after I'd had my first baby, actually. I had her strapped to me while running the convention. So, yeah, those are the two biggest bodies of awards. And as Marianne said, there are a few others associated, like the Chandler and the William Atheling, which is an award for criticism and review, which is something that I'd really love to see extended internationally, actually. I mean, I'm very proud of the Atheling that I've won, but also the nice thing about the Atheling is that it's for a specific work of criticism. It's not just for, you know, somebody is not necessarily for the person, it's for a work. And I think particularly as we're getting to a point, I noticed with the Hugos that the conversation around fan writer is getting more difficult because, you know, who is a fan writer? Do they count or no longer count if they earn any money for their fan writing? Does their writing have to be fanish if it's critical? All that sort of thing. Whereas the Atheling is quite nice. It doesn't care whether you got paid or not. All it cares is whether you wrote something that people thought was interesting. So I'm quite a bit of a champion of that award. I like to sort of push people to nominate stuff each year and to remember what it's actually for and not just, you know, write down their five favorite book reviewers, because book reviewers are lovely, but you have to remember which thing they wrote specifically. Fandom generally, I think because we have such a small and such a widespread community that there's always been a lot of overlap between fandom and professionals. Like, all of our conventions are pretty much made up of fans and writers and, you know, professionals, and everybody kind of mucks in together. And I think some of our early, we had some really early examples of writers who were part of fandom and then became professional writers and kept their feet in fandom. Sean Williams is a great example of that, somebody who's a big advocate for just mucking in, and people just go along to the convention. You don't expect to be a guest. You don't expect to have your membership comped or anything like that. Everybody just goes along. A lot of the people voting in the DITMARS are also professional writers. A lot of people who run in conventions may be also professional writers as well as being fans. So we have a lot of that overlap and a lot of and things have maybe changed a little bit more with the internet, and it means that we're all able to create other fan communities that aren't necessarily regional. There's a lot more collaborative projects that happen now because we can all talk instead of having to wait until we get together once a year. But I think the fact that it is, because Australia is really, really, really big and there's lots of really long distances between most of our cities, and particularly between the places where our NatCons are held. And so, yeah, I don't really know what it was like in the days before the internet, because the internet was really the reason that I got involved in fandom. The two kind of really happened around about the same time. But yeah, there's a lot of people who are wearing five hats, whether that is I am a publisher, I am a writer, I am a fan, I am an awards administrator, I am a convention runner. It's very rare to find someone who just does one thing. And we have people like Kat Sparks, for instance, who started out, a lot of her early recognition was for her artwork. She then became one of our foremost small press publishers. She then quit that because, why would you not, frankly? I don't know why anybody actually becomes a small press publisher. I have, you know, some of my best friends are small press publishers, but really. And then now she's working on her professional writing. She's got recognition as a short story writer. There's a lot of that. We're all wearing many hats. Yes.
Awesome. Okay, so we're running a little bit on the long side. So I just want to get you both to talk about your work before we totally run out of time, because we could probably ask you millions and millions of more questions. But, you guys, I guess, you're awake, so it's morning, right? Because you're like 900 hours ahead?
Yep.
Okay. Oh, okay. Whew. Okay. Because, man, I was just thinking, like, if you were in the UK right now, it'd be midnight. But no, it's morning. So we'll start with you, Marianne. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you've got stuff coming out from Edgar Robot. I can't remember what the publication date is for those. But if you wanted to talk about what you've got coming, you know, fairly recently, maybe give us some plot synopses, kind of tell people, you know, what kind of cool stuff they can expect from you. That'd be really great.
Oh, the pitch. Well, basically, I have two books coming out from Angry Robot. The first one this May, called Peacemaker, and it is, as I said, a science fiction, Western Australiana occult something or other. And that's a lot of fun. I think the second book will be out at the equivalent time the following year. I also write crime under the name of Marianne Delacourt, and so I've got a book coming out. Well, I have another book due for that. So they're kind of my current projects. And I have just finished a teen series called the Night Creatures series, which is science fiction slash fantasy. It's a very dark, it's actually not, I don't classify it as dystopic, but it's a very dark coming of age story. So that's actually all available on Amazon now. It's a trilogy. I've got a bunch of other projects on, but probably nothing significant to mention at this point in time. So that's about it. Tans?
Yeah, well, my latest release is Ink Black Magic, which is both the third, it's the final book of the series that I started writing in the late 90s, but it's also, it's rewritten to reboot the series for a new audience. But it's basically funny fantasy fiction based around actually comic book heroes and an awful lot of magic going wrong. The whole premise of that series is that magic basically is bad and anything you do with magic is basically not going to work because why would it? And it's a story of a former heroine of fantasy adventures who's now settled down at university teaching students never to use magic. So that's with Fablecroft, Ink Black Magic. I also, with Fablecroft, am editing a book called Cranky Ladies of History, which is a mixture of historical and fantasy fiction. We've been taking pictures and soliciting stories, and we're going to be running a Kickstarter in March to try and get pro rates for those authors, which is sort of one of those exciting developments for Fablecroft. But it's also a really cool project. Oh, the pictures are amazing. We kept getting this email after email about just amazing women that people wanted to write about, which has been very exciting, especially when Harley's like, I haven't heard of this one. And I'm looking at it going, yeah, I've got a PhD in history and I've never heard of that person either. Quick to the Google machine. It's a really exciting project. I also write crime. Like Marianne, under a different name, Livia Day. My first crime novel came out last year, and the sequel, Drowned Vanilla, will be coming out mid-year, I'm going to say, with 12 Planet Press, their new Deadlines imprint, which is interested in crime novels writers.
Mm.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I have all those things. I also have a project which has not officially launched or talked about publicly yet, but it's going to be a web serial that I am playing with that I want to start sometime this year because I just really want to write a web serial. And I have a really cool idea and I'm very excited about it. So I will be saying more about that in due course.
Excellent, excellent. And really quick from both of you, so we'll start with you, Marianne, where folks can find you, I mean, like your website or if you have any special places you want to let people know about.
You can find me at www.mariannedepierre.com fairly easily. But I also have my YA site, which I created for the Burn Bright series, has actually developed into more of a young adult zine. So it's now called The Escape Club, and we cover not only a huge amount of book reviews, speculative YA, but we run all sorts of features for teens, and we have great recipes as well. We've got an amazing cook who does these incredible yummy baking sort of things. So that's at www.burnbright.com.au. And I also have a website for my crime, which is www.tarasharp.com.au. So you can find me in a lot of places.
Excellent.
And thanks, guys. It's been fantastic. Really enjoyed and been really a bonus to be able to talk to my buddy Tansy as well.
I miss you, Marianne. We need to get together more.
And really quick, Tansy, where people can find you, obviously Galactic Suburbia.
That's right. Galactic Suburbia is about to make its comeback for 2014. We're recording a new episode next week. Elisa had a baby last year, so we've taken a little bit longer summer holiday than usual to let her get over that. But apparently her baby does better when socializing, so we're hoping to be able to get in lots of Galactic Suburbia episodes this year. So, yes, much like my children, who apparently behaves better in when she's around other people than just when she's around her parents, so which you'd think would be a good thing. It's actually quite inconvenient. Sorry. Galactic Suburbia can be found online through iTunes or directly from our site. My website is www.tansyrr.com. You can find links to all sorts of things there. I'm also TansyRR on Twitter. And I often talk there. So those are probably the best places to find me.
Excellent.
I just quickly jump in and say I apologise if there's been terrible background noise while I've been talking to you, but my neighbour's been mowing the lawn the whole time. So
it happens.
It's a good Australian gardening.
And we'll just pretend it was Skype.
It's the authentic Sunday morning Australia experience.
Absolutely.
Well, excellent. So, Julia, do you have any last things you wanted to bring up? Or?
No, I think we're good. I mean, I could keep asking questions probably for a long time, but I think maybe we can let Tansy and Marianne get on with their days.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, well, thank you, Tansy, for coming on and talking to us about all of this and taking the time out of your day. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's very cool. And as it's just so nice to talk to Marianne. I didn't even know she was coming on when I said yes to this, but if I had, I would have agreed. I know, even faster. It's lovely to talk to her too.
And thank you, Marianne, for the same, taking the time out of your day and everything. It's really, really great.
Thank you for taking an interest in our genre fiction, and certainly something that we could talk about forever and a day. We're passionate about, and we really appreciate your interest in it. It's lovely to meet you both.
You too. Awesome. All right, Julia, and thank you for, because you're my, co-host, so thank you for being awesome.
You're welcome. I showed up.
Excellent. All right. Well, and on that note, awkward ending.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And yeah, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And, of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So, in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.